Hello and welcome to another episode of the Black Business Psychology Network's podcast. I am your host, Dr. Grace Mantra-Owusu, and today our special guest is someone that's extremely accomplished. He has not one, but two doctoral qualifications under his belt. We have Dr. Luke Brown with us today, and he completed his undergraduate degree in criminology and psychology. Then he went on to complete a master's in research or an MRes at the University of Birmingham, and he then went to complete a PhD on a project called the Enrich Project, and he did that with the University of Warwick, and it was looking at ethnicity, mental health and help-seeking behaviours within the Black community in the West Midlands, people who had experienced their first episode of psychosis. As if that wasn't enough, Luke then decided to apply to the clinical doctorate in psychology, and he got on to the clinical doctorate in psychology, which is the professional qualification to become a clinical psychologist. So just as he was finishing his PhD write-up and his thesis and submitting it and doing his viva, he had also started a clinical doctorate at the University of Birmingham as well. So currently he works as a clinical psychologist within the West Midlands and Birmingham area. So if you want to hear more about his journey and experiences and some of the really interesting work that he does, please stay tuned. And once again, thank you for everybody who has been supporting the podcast. The feedback has been really great. I actually got a really lovely message this week from a gentleman that said he'd listened to every single episode, and I just wanted to say, like, these episodes are for people to dip in and out of, and if you ever want to hear people's career journeys and career experiences in psychology, please share and also please tune in. So thanks very much. I hope you all enjoy this. Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Black Business Psychology Network's podcast. I have here Dr. Can I call you Dr. Squared? Do you I know that sounds like a stupid question, like Dr. Luke Brown, or are you just Dr. Luke Brown, PhD, professional doctorate? Dr. Brown.
I'm happy with any title. there's a rare breed of us who have two doctorates, and we call ourselves Dr. Squared. That's more of an in-joke, but I'm happy with just Dr. Luke Brown is fine.
I'm going to have to do Dr. Squared because, yeah, I just find it, it's like, you know, I'm not happy with one doctorate. I have to have two. Like, I've got a cousin who's a medical doctor and has done a PhD, and I have a friend the same. And I just think that you guys are just, you love the punishment, clearly.
We do.
So, Dr. Luke Brown Squared, thank you for joining us today. I'm really excited to record this podcast with you. So first of all, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, I think you've met me already, but my name's Luke Brown, and I'm a clinical psychologist calling from Birmingham. Up north, I suppose, from you anyway.
Midlands. I learned the hard way.
Midlands. Yeah, there's something above Oxford, and that's the Midlands. So I work in a early intervention service, right. In a place called Warsaw, and we support young people from the ages of 16 to 35 traditionally, although our services change over time. People experiencing a first episode of psychosis. So people might refer to that as schizophrenia, where people experience voice hearing, visual hallucinations, paranoia,
right,
quite a severe and potentially enduring mental illness, that has devastating effects on people's lives. And so the ethos of the service is essentially trying to get in as early as possible, provide all this holistic MDT approach of informed care, to prevent people from essentially being revolving door patients where they're in and out of hospital for the rest of their lives.
Absolutely. And what does MDT stand for?
Multidisciplinary team. I think, Nancy in her podcast kind of talked about this, I think, but we work with psychiatric nurses of in the working community. We have an occupational therapist. We have a social worker. We have a team manager who's nursing by background. And we have psychiatrists. And psychiatrists are medically trained doctors that work in the same team as us, but they'll be able to prescribe medication and have the ability to recommend people these sections and under the Mental Health Act, and right. basically go into hospital.
Yeah. Whereas clinical psychologists don't have the prescription powers or the informing people that they should be sectioned. That's what the psychiatrists do.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. Well, thank you for giving us a bit of a background about your job role and who you are. And the next question is, and this is a very, like, it's a funny question, because every time I ask it, they're like, well, that's a bit broad, isn't it? But I will ask it. So how did you get to Luke Brown, doctor? How did it start, your interest in psychology and the journey to where you are now?
Okay. It actually starts with my dad, actually. So I don't know the kind of mean age of your listeners, but in like the 80s, let's go back. Right. I'm not that old. I was born in 86, but in the 80s and before, there was a whole different notion of mental health, really. Where there were these big asylums, a massive kind of institutes, really, where people would go in and stay in these big old buildings, really, as hospitals, and have care from like the youth until like death, really. And I think around of like, you know, the like in the 90s, early 2000s, 80s to 90s, there was an introduction of a new Mental Health Care Act, which looked at community care. So these big asylums that existed, almost like kind of like, I don't know, like big, really quite regal places, really. And they were all disbanded. And my dad was a handyman in these old asylums, really, in Birmingham. So they had their own, like, you know, garden, their own kind of woodshop work rooms, the wards, big kind of like halls for like entertaining the patients who had mental health problems, who were in these hospitals, really. And he would was a handyman and essentially went around and fixed any doors that were broken. And I suppose in the, that was his job. And as growing up, there was a big kind of black mental health carers movement in Birmingham, really, because before community care existed, there were lots of young black men with quite severe enduring mental health problems, schizophrenia, psychosis. They had no family support and were just in these institutes, basically. And so he's part of this kind of like charity organisation who would volunteer and every Christmas would put on events to help them rehabilitate. So, and would volunteer, and we would, as a family, would volunteer, and my mom and my brother. And I thought they were really quite crazy, actually. I didn't like it much. But, so basically, as mental health became more modernised and we had these new community mental health teams and these old asylums and these old kind of, hospitals were closed down, they were looking for people to be trained as nurses. And so he trained as a community. Yeah, and at the same time, I was doing my A-levels in psychology. So I always learned about schizophrenia and all these really interesting kind of like, you know, mental disorders. And, that, and back then, it's a bit on PC now, but back then it was called abnormal psychology. And I was fascinated by, you know, health and, you know, the weird and wonderful kind of mental health conditions of schizophrenia. And he was training as a nurse. And so, so went to university, did psychology and criminology undergrad, following my A-levels in psychology. And there I had a real interest in the applied clinical kind of work, and kind of wanted to do more research, really, to get kind of like interested in, you know, what's this mental health thing about, really, what psychology is about. So I did a master's at the University of Birmingham. That was straight after university. So living back in Birmingham with my family.
I was going to say, local then. living away for you.
I mean, I went away to my undergrad, but for since then I did my master's. And that was looking at suicide and psychosis with like one of the professors at the University of Birmingham. And at the end of that, like, year master's, my research was in kind of like, you know, psychosis and suicide in young people. It was like a big project that was that they had won some money for, basically from the government, to research into looking at ethnicity and mental health. My supervisor was like, you should apply for this, you know. And I was like, oh, I don't know, I think I want to do a bit clinical. He was like, oh yeah, go for it, you know, it's a research job, an opportunity to do a PhD. It's done within the service, so I knew all the people already. And so I just applied for this kind of job as a research associate on this big grant. And attached to the research, so I was a paid NHS employee as a researcher, was a kind of like a stipend for, and I got a studentship for a PhD, basically.
Is that the 3+1 ERSC thing, like model?
No, it's separate. It was kind of built into the grant anyway. So I was collecting data on this big project, was looking at ethnicity and mental health. It's called the Enrich Project. You can Google it. You can find a report. And I kind of carved out a small piece of it using the data and collecting some more data to make my PhD thesis back on, really. And my key question was looking at why do Black people have higher rates of admission under the Mental Health Act during a first episode of psychosis, basically. So when, you know, if you kind of imagine, you know, everyone has been equal. Why is it that when Black people come into the mental health system with schizophrenia or psychotic-like symptoms, do they come through the more kind of coercive routes, which might be police involvement or admitted and sectioned, rather than rocking up your GP, saying I'm unwell, and having this kind of nice theory, seamless transition into kind of like care where your life's interrupted.
So like less traumatic, basically, slightly less traumatic.
And that statistic has been around for years, like, you know, and there's lots of debate within the psychiatry literature about the reasons behind this. Is it about institutional racism? Is it about help seeking? Lots of theories, but not much clear empirical evidence, really. So that was part of my story. Anyway, that was 5 years, because I was doing it part-time. So I was doing it part-time. So obviously I was working as a full-time researcher, but the kind of clinic components from writing up was was on top of that, really, outside of those hours. Although I did get some allocated time towards the end of the project. And then I was thinking, well, what's next, really? And I felt like, well, actually, I do want to become more of a clinician, really. I want to be working in a therapeutic capacity rather than a researcher. And eventually kind of blur those two worlds at some point. So I applied for the course in my doctorate in clinical psychology. I applied for, like, I don't know if many people know, but you kind of apply centrally. You know, I was like Institute of Psychiatry in London, Manchester, Norwich, the University of East Anglia and Birmingham. Put my application in, not thinking I'll get anywhere because I hadn't had much clinical experience, but lots of research experience, and I got on straight away, really. But I had my write-up to do for my thesis at the same time and my Viva. So I'd started a new course, hadn't quite finished my PhD yet, and these things were both happening in the same year. It was very stressful.
Understatement. When I was writing up, no, not when I was writing, when I'd submitted, I'd started a new job. Which was not in academia. So yeah, I had a Viva like 3 months into that new job. It's mad, but yours sounds worse.
It was really taxing, really. And but I got through it in the end, and the writing was really hard. I got a lot of support from people, and I passed it, I finished it, submitted it, and I was then on the doctorate learning that's for another 3 years, learning how to become a clinical psychologist.
That is so intense.
And that's really like the really start of my career as a clinical psychologist, really. I then went on to qualify and work in paediatrics in the similar way that Nancy was working in an old podcast, and she mentioned that. And then about 2 years in, I was thinking, actually, I want to go back to psychosis, and now I'm back working with young people. And that's my career journey, really.
I like how you said it so like, so like I did a master's and then I got a job and then I did a doctorate. It used to make it sound so like seamless and like there's no pain in the I mean, there's pain in the story, but like you've glossed over it a tiny bit. And let me just go back to the master's. Was that an MRes?
MRes, yeah, it was master's in research.
Right.
Yes, it was applied. I was doing research in the NHS. Clinical issues, really. The way the MRes worked is like you do in your first placement, you're doing like research skills, like statistics and research methods and all that kind of jazz, the basic stuff that's important at a high level. And you're setting yourself up for a summer placement. And mine was with psychosis research, looking at what factors cause people to commit suicide when experiencing it in the early psychosis phase of the illness. And my mid-placement was working with in a kind of CAM service, a community organisation who were trying to look at low-level psychological well-being in schools for people from disadvantaged backgrounds.
Wow.
And I was doing like a literature review. Volunteering. And that was it really. You did dissertation at the end, submit it, then you're done really. But it was, and that got me the research bug, I suppose, really,
That MRes sounds really interesting, because the people I know have done MRes, not in psychology. I didn't realise it was like placements, and then you kind of got to choose a variety of different things. That sounds actually a really good preparation for either a PhD route or the doctorate, the professional doctorate, because you've got a research component in that.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it was applied research, which allows you to straddle both.
Yeah, and it opened you to working with teams in the NHS, because obviously I was recruiting participants from real health teams, so I got exposure to that. My supervisors were clinicians primarily with academic backgrounds, so they kind of straddled both worlds. And most people on that MRes just went on to the Birmingham themselves. There's about 10 of us, and I think at least 8 people that are now qualified clinical psychologists. But a really useful thing to do. And back then it was cheap as well, it was like $3,000.
I was going to ask you how much did it cost.
It was dirt cheap, it was like $3,000. Best investment ever. I mean, now masters, I don't know what, it'll be like 10 grand.
10 grand, they're around 10 grand. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got in there just when it was, I hate how we're saying $3,000 is cheap in comparison to what it is now, and in comparison to Americans who pay like tens of thousands of pounds for like a semester. Also interested in your PhD research. So you were researching the differences in Black patients' admission rates for psychosis. What did you find? Was there anything clear cut? And obviously, you're probably going to
bringing up like an old lover. Because she was like my everything that PhD.
I hear you.
So essentially what I was proposing with this hypothesis, and I called it the crisis hypothesis. And what I was suggesting was that a part of the reason why the rates were higher for Black Caribbean patients, in terms of the rates of admission, that was the group I focused on, Black Caribbean, was they were coming to services in a crisis. So there was no early help seeking at all. I think most people, when they're in that unwell, don't have awareness that they are unwell. And actually, it's the role of the family and the community around them that actually does a lot of the help seeking for them. So I've identified, I think, maybe like 8 variables that all kind of like promoted this idea of kind of like crisis help seeking,
right?
Which was like having no social support, not seeking help early enough. The symptoms weren't that different between the groups. It wasn't about symptom presentation. People's beliefs about the illness, they were very, it seemed like actually for the Black Caribbean patients, they couldn't identify any early warning signs. Like they said I was pretty much fine. And then I was, and there was this idea about like in the literature about it, insidious and prolonged, I think the word is, maybe I've got this wrong, like onset, so a quite acute onset, like this drawn out thing. And then looked at kind of like cultural beliefs and how different cultures made sense of early levels of distress, anxiety, low mood, distress, and alternative help seeking behaviours. So, rather than go to the GP, if I'm unwell, I might go to an aunt, or I might go to a spiritual leader.
Yeah.
I can't exactly remember the exact findings, but it was essentially looking at these variables, and there was some qualitative research looking at cognitive carers about their experiences.
Right.
But I didn't look at like the service level variables. So, you know, what people like when they do change, with a difference in terms of how people perceive their illness, or, you know, biases in terms of people's appraisal of their severity of their illness. I didn't look at that kind of stuff. It was mainly looking at the help seeking and the stuff before people even come to services, really, and could learn anything from that.
Brilliant.
And that was it, really. Basically, people seemed to be like they came in crisis, but the reason what led to the crisis was the unknown, really. Why come in crisis? And that was the outcome. Yeah.
Brilliant. And were you able? Obviously, we all know that psychology, publish or perish. Were you able to publish any of it from both your theses? Well, three of your theses actually. Not just.
No. It's still sitting on my shelf, looking at me. Shaming me with its I wrote a big report for the National Institute of Health Research. That was a big dissemination piece, and that's like available, and there were lots of papers from the project that I was like second author on.
Brilliant.
Because it was a bigger project that I was involved in, not just my thing.
But
my stuff just still sits there, and I suppose it's a bit of regret, really. It's like I want to go back and get this stuff out there, but I then was on a doctorate and I was doing like assignments, and then I was doing some more research as part of the doctorate, and then, you know, life takes over, family and all this jazz, and I'm still like in the wake of all that, really. But one day I want to go back to it. I want to get it out and dust it off and update the literature and just whack it out there somehow.
It's not going anywhere. It's sitting on a shelf, so whenever you're ready. And also you don't have to do it, but like, you know, it's just one of those questions everyone, you know, when you do a PhD or any kind of research, are you going to publish it? And there are other ways you can get it out there, aren't there?
Out there, I mean, they did try, and I got knocked back a few times from publishers.
Yeah.
I think that was a bit disheartening, because it was like I put a lot of effort. I'm quite a slow writer. I put a lot of effort to kind of get knocked back. And I think that just, it was a battle I wasn't really ready for, really, because I had other things to focus on.
A whole other doctorate.
Yeah. And the stuff was quite novel, and it's quite politically charged as well. And, you know, my supervisor, I think, had very different views to, like, you know, these other clinical professors across the nation who had views very differently. And it just was such a contentious issue, filled with lots of debate. And, I never knew what the sticking point was behind it. But, the university seemed to like it, and got some positive feedback.
Well, it sounds amazing. So, like, whenever you're ready, I'll be happy to give it a read. So, your professional doctorate, well, actually, your professional doctorate experience. So, you've come out of this PhD, you start a professional doctorate, you've got to do a viva for your PhD, and you started this whole brand new course. What is that like for you?
Oh, it was stressful. I think on a number of levels, really. I mean, I suppose I came from the doctorate having a very kind of, from my PhD, having a very academic view of mental health, quite psychiatrically driven, because my PhD was in the medical school, and my supervisor was a psychiatrist. And on the doctorate, I was almost like given a whole new lens to make sense of mental health and distress. You know, the first year, you're given all these like theories and models to kind of explain mental distress that is essentially different to the biological, psychiatric, medical model, really.
Yeah.
And I remember me, of course, thinking I was like quite an okay kind of person, got it together.
Yeah.
It might be different ways of making sense of myself. And then it quite like become like an eye-opening experience about myself, really.
Yeah.
Thinking about, I think I realised I actually had anxiety, like an emotion that exists, you know, and sometimes I get sad. And I have ways of coping that are quite covert. And obviously, you've been asked to deliver this, you know, use these skills to kind of help other people. I remember one lecture, it was about using psychodynamic theory, and I after lectures, I kind of came home to was my girlfriend there, but now it's my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, babes, I've got problems. I drew out this map of last.
You drew a map.
I was like, oh, this is me. Because we showed this like mapping like lectures, and I was like, yeah. Oh, it's like a map of, you know, well, it's like a model ring, like a diagram of like how to understand like interpersonal difficulties.
Yeah.
That first year was like, there's so many challenges in some ways, like A, learning a whole new discipline, rethinking what I knew about mental health and distress from a more psychological perspective.
Mm.
Undergrad in psychology, I think the applied knowledge was really powerful. And I didn't come from a kind of an assistant psychology route, I came from an academic route. So
yeah.
I wasn't exposed to it in any detail, a little bit, but not in any kind of great detail. And so that first year was just like, yeah. And then just remember, just even being able to be identify my vulnerabilities, like, I'm imperfect, and these are the things that I struggle with, and these are my experiences in the past. And it was really revolutionary.
It's a bit of an ordeal, isn't it? It's like you go through a wash and then you come out and then you're just like, I just feel what's happened.
Yeah. And the stress of the course itself, like all the assignments you have to do, and me do the Viva on top of that for my PhD, and then get that paper out, get my thesis written, and I was trying to also write papers from the PhD. It was just, I think there was something about me that I identified in all of that. It was about, why do I do this to myself? What's all this about? And now I had a language to talk about it, which was, you know, psychology.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Like, I'm not sure on the clinical doctorate if there's a component making you did you have to do personal therapy at all, like as part of the course?
No, I mean, I trained at Birmingham, so that personal therapy wasn't a requirement, it was an optional thing. But I, on the course, you got like different support systems, really. So your appraisal tutor, and that was a member of the course team, and they would follow you through your various placements to make sure that you're ticking off your competencies.
Yeah.
Then you had your supervisor on placement, and they were a clinician in the NHS, making sure you were doing the job and setting goals and supporting you through the application of your skills and how you work with your clients.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had another group, another kind of support system, and that was your personal tutor.
Right.
And she was like a lady who was a psychologist, but not related to the course. That's when I could just talk to about my experience on the course.
Right.
And that was a bit like personal therapy in a way, because she would often, you'd share your problems, how you find the course, and she would help me formulate it from a psychological point of view.
Brilliant.
And, you know, there's lots of challenges in that first year, and that was a really helpful space. It was essentially therapy, but it was more kind of boundaried and more focused about the course.
Academic, more focused,
But she was helping to draw in lots of different parts about myself, to make sense, my cultural background, my spiritual beliefs, all these things, how they influence me, and how I approach challenges, really. So that was really good, yeah.
That sounds fantastic. It does sound like you were held in all of the areas of the doctorate. So it wasn't like you were just dangling around, like trying to do all this stuff by yourself, even though you were, but like there was support there. And that's really good to hear, because with such a course and such a demanding period of time of your life, I think that you probably need that and more. So the structure of the clinical doctorate, because I had no idea. Like, obviously, I know people that had done clinical doctorates or other doctorates in psychology, but actually the breakdown, obviously not too much detail, of like what happens, like what do you do year one, year two, year three, and how is it in terms of the assignments as well? How does that work?
Yeah. Oh, it's a long time ago now. But
vague.
The way Birmingham work, I think most courses work, although there might be some variability in this, in that you have about 5 placements. So in your first year, you have like this long 1-year placement, essentially. I think it's about 10 months in total, where you're just in one area. And my first was adult mental health. And so I was working in a kind of community mental health team, offering psychological therapy to clients basically with, you know, quite severe, secondary level mental health needs. So not just generic anxiety, depression, but anxiety, depression with suicidal risk or self-harm.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on a psychology waiting list, and I picked them up and met with them weekly to do psychological informed work.
Yeah.
My supervisor at the time was, so we trained them, of course, to do CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy.
I was going to ask, yeah.
That was the main focus and the main competency, but my supervisor was interested in cognitive analytic therapy.
Ooh.
Which is a kind of a deeper level type of therapy that is about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was almost like on that placement, learning it, like, I was learning a model on the course. On placement, I was learning a new model and then applying that new model to my clients.
Wow.
So that was my first year. In my second year, I then went to work with children with learning disabilities.
Interesting.
And that was a specialist placement.
Yeah.
And that was more about working with pet parents and carers.
Wow.
And schools and the systems around children with LD and children themselves, so that we could work through emotional disturbances.
Mm-hmm.
There might be sensory issues, mm-hmm. or emotional issues. And that was my second placement. My third placement was in a older adult physical health placement, and that was working on a ward.
Yeah.
Older adults who had, like, basically everything else apart from dementia. So they were like, you know, it's like toileting issues, fragility, physical health problems, mental health problems, and also helping the team around the client to think psychologically, nurses, about the way in which they support this client group, really. And then in my last placement, last year, so this is year three now, I did a placement in paediatrics. So that's working with young people with physical health conditions.
Right.
I really enjoyed that, in particular working with people with medically unexplained symptoms. When people have medical problems, but
they
don't find any biological or organic reason why they have these problems. It might be like, you know, unexplained pain. You know, I've got this pain in my arm and I don't know what's going on with it.
Yeah.
And actually a lot of these things were
psychological.
Had a psychological, you know, some kind of trauma or something. That was really interesting. And I remember working with lots of people. And that was really, really good. And then you're doing work on the ward as well. So, you know, someone comes in from a road traffic accident, a kid gets knocked off his bike.
Yeah.
Family in crisis, the team's in crisis, you know. You're on the ward doing, like, like, in the moment psychology. Like, there's no time to sit back and read a book and formulate. You're just doing live psychology with the team, formulate on the fly. It was a very different way of working. And then also I went to my early intervention placement, and that was working with the job that I'm doing now. I did a placement in that area. And that's it, really. So five placements, and then along top of that, every placement you do like a report, recording reports, and there to demonstrate one area of speciality as a psychologist.
So the competencies, whatever.
Yeah. Right? So one was about, like, can you formulate from two different perspectives? Can you do a single case design? Can you do a service evaluation?
Mm-hmm.
Can you demonstrate your ability to do leadership?
Okay.
And then you have an oral CPR at the end as well, which I did an intervention, especially placement for people who are at risk of developing psychosis, basically. And that was one of my areas. That's it, really. So there was no exams, just all kind of placement coursework based.
Yeah.
Teaching every Friday throughout, so you learn different models, neuropsychology, different psychological theories, cognitive behavioral therapy, systemic therapy, neuropsychology, the whole shebang, really. Former different models, different theoretical approaches, and you're using those skills, you know, throughout the 3 years.
Yeah, because the rest of the time you're actually in. You're in the real world. So you're like, okay, I learned this on Friday. Let me use it today.
Yeah. So you had like one day, and also along that you're doing the research as well. So you're doing more research, yeah. So one day you had a study day, which may involve getting my hair cut or not.
Listen, we've all got to fit it in. That's, if COVID has taught us nothing, you've got to fit it in.
It was a nice kind of relaxed day, but I ended up just spending pretty much the whole day doing the work, but spreading it up between like 7:30 and like 7:30 at night, really.
Yeah.
And then we did 3 days in placement, and then one day was this study day where you had lectures, and these were at the university, face to face.
Yeah.
specialist will come in and you learn, brilliant, you know, a different theory. Yeah.
Brilliant. That sounds so interesting. And now looking back, obviously you've given us an example of what it was like with the PhD, which was much more academic. It was much more kind of like psychiatric medical model, as opposed to like the doctorate, the clinical doctorate, which was like you're a practitioner, you are in the hospitals, or you're on placement, you have to apply this stuff, you don't have time to kind of like you said, read a book in a middle of a trauma situation. So I don't want to ask like which one do you prefer, because that's kind of like choosing which is your favorite kid. That's probably not going to be the case, but like, what did you learn from both? Like, if you could think of two things, and how has that informed your actual practice now?
Yeah. I think I use them equally. So in all the roles I have worked, or any kind of case I work with, the evidence base is really important to me. Yeah. So thinking about what does the research say about this particular way of working?
Mm-hmm.
There's research around how you work with teams.
Yeah.
There's research around therapeutic relationship. There's research around particular types of models and how effective they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose for me, I always like to draw on a broader knowledge base to make sense of all the work that I do. And I think that definitely came from the PhD, really. Also in that work about being quite analytical and critical of evidence as well.
Yeah.
So just because the evidence says one thing, thinking about my clients and how they may or may not differ from the research, really.
Yeah.
And so having that kind of ability to critically appraise evidence and literature in my practice, I think has come from my PhD. And the ability to kind of, I suppose, interpret data and think about ways to measure the effectiveness of the work that I do, to understand stats and how that might make sense of, say, someone's cognitive, you know, neuropsych report and the data that comes from that and that stuff. And then I suppose the clinical doctorate, like, is actually the theory and the reflection and my relationship with my client and my relationship with the team, all that kind of interpersonal sense making stuff, and thinking about language and use of language and the kind of, that's the doing, I suppose. So that's my approach. Everything I kind of do, it seems to come from an academic place in terms of the broader picture. But how I apply it to my clients is very much the clinical skills that I have and drawing on those simultaneously, really. You know, other people might not have that experience, might be more clinically led, just about what they feel and like use their internal feelings as a way to shape their interventions. And that definitely has a strength, and I use that as well. But I think my approach seems to be about...
Well, thank you so much for that. And it's really interesting to hear about the difference in approaches and what you learn from each, or what you learn from all of your different academic experiences. And the next kind of question I've got to ask is around, obviously for your PhD thesis, it was around race and mental health, and the research you were doing on your MRes, a similar area. And it's the question I'm asking is, how did you, as a Black male in these spaces of psychology, in wards, in clinics, on the PhD and on your professional doctorate, how did that shape your experience? If so, how? And it's both the intersection of race and gender, because from my experience in psychology, there's certain areas of psychology that are much more female dominated, for example. So, how did you navigate that and process it, I suppose?
I remember, it's a bit of a journey, I suppose. I remember in my master's, I was the only Black guy on the course, the only Black person on my course, and there was only 10 of us. And I remember like talking to my friends on the course and be like, oh, I don't want to be known as a black, but the psychologist who just does black issues.
Yeah.
And in that mind, I was like, oh, I felt it was quite limited. It was like, well, actually, I felt as good as everyone else.
Yeah, like, and you can research other stuff as well. Like,
yeah, like, it's not just... And then this job came up on the Enrich project while doing the research job, and I was doing a PhD alongside it, and that was actually about black issues. And all of a sudden I was forced into this kind of confronting, like, oh, this is not sexually interesting to me, and it's really meaningful.
Yeah.
And it's about inequality and services. Mm. And then I have to reflect about myself, about why it's important and my own experiences, although not in a psychological way, it was more about an awareness.
Yeah.
I remember my Viva, you could do this Viva, and I passed it with minor corrections. But one of the things they asked for me was to write a kind of a personal section, chapter, about my ethnicity and how that might influence how I interpret the data.
Wow.
And it was almost like academia was asking me to bring my blackness into like my work, really.
How did you feel about that?
It was really good, I think. I think I was shying away from it because I wanted to be just seen as a professional, really.
Like objective, so to speak.
Objective, unbiased. I was very clear about the way I chose the variables I chose and the theories that in the Pundit and the literature. And, you know, my view of science and psychological science is that, you know, we need to be as objective and scientific as possible to remove bias. But that chapter made me think, actually, this whole process is really a biased and subjective experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, by me selecting some variables and excluding others, there's a whole reason behind why I did that. And so I think being asked to kind of think about, and this was mainly in relation to my qualitative chapter.
Yeah, I thought so. I just think so, because you've the reflexivity side. Anyway, yeah, exactly.
Was just interesting to about think about how I related to my clients. So I was talking to moms.
Yeah.
That were my mom's age. Mm. I was talking to young people that were not dissimilar to me. Mm. It enabled me to use and understand and interpret their language in a way that was... Obviously, I'm from Birmingham. They were from Birmingham. Mm. There was that kind of ability to kind of interpret language and connect with them.
Yeah.
People would often talk about places in the city, and I was like, oh, yeah, that place. Yeah, I know that street. And it enabled me to connect to them. And so I wondered whether, and things they shared about their experiences, I don't know if that would differ whether my ethnicity was black or white or another ethnicity, but I do think that familiarity made people feel more comfortable enough to be able to just be raw about their experiences and be quite open about the struggles. Mm. And race didn't come up that much, to be honest with you, in the qualitative interviews. It was more about the kind of invisible aspects of race. So like, no one was there to help me, or I didn't like experience racism in terms of people telling me I didn't feel like I was treated differently, but the systems weren't there, or I felt let down, or I didn't actually know. No one really thought, no one told me. So that made me feel like it was. I think there was an authenticity in what people were saying.
And the systemic area of kind of where prejudice and racism intersects, it's not all about going around calling people the N-word. That doesn't tend to happen very often. About exclusion and belonging and feeling supported. Those are the measure, that's what you're measuring, rather than, well, as well as actually the more explicit stuff, but doesn't really tend to manifest in the same way.
And the whole part of the chapter, I suppose, was me kind of contextualizing Birmingham as a city, and you know, think about the migration histories that existed here following the Second World War, you know, my grandparents' generation, and the industrialization of Birmingham, the lack of jobs and opportunities, and then being and deprivation that mainly exists in the areas that have the higher rates of psychosis and admission, yeah. all that kind of stuff was all important to kind of weave together, and it helped make sense of myself really, my journey as well, and the journey of my family as well in the city. So I don't know if I would have answered your question or not, but how does my ethnicity and gender connect to the journey of psychology?
Or like your journey in psychology, but no, you have answered it, because it's kind of like that reflexivity side, so being asked to put that into the thesis, which I think is great, and then you were thinking about all your journeys or histories and how you interact with the people that you were, that participants, yeah, and yeah. also I'm sure those things come into mind when you're working with clients as well, client groups from different backgrounds, and how you interact with them and what's yeah. what's coming up for you whilst you're working for them. So it's kind of like a lifelong professional discipline to be able to yeah. to be aware of that and what it brings to you and what comes out.
Yeah, I think even my practice as well, like some models of psychology, very kind of Westernly influenced models, look at distress as being in the individual, like the internal person.
Yeah.
And it kind of takes away the reality of social environmental factors.
Yeah.
And so I suppose, I grew up in a working class area. Although my parents had stable jobs, so we had a two-parent income.
Mm-hmm.
So even though our class was working class, we're never really kind of, I suppose, poor.
Yeah.
But I was almost like I was traveling those two worlds throughout my life, really. Yeah. Like, I've been aware of actually this part of town where this part of the family lives, oh gosh, that's like really difficult and really rough. And there's these physical barriers.
Yeah.
And then these kind of part of town where my other parts, my friends might live, have so much affluence and space, and there's these parks and all these things. And so I think those kind of things influence the way I think about people's distress. Like,
yes.
if people are anxious or low or behaving oddly or doing things that we might not understand, it's not just about them. It might be about the interaction between them and their environment and them and the people that are around them. And so I think in some of my practice, I often try to think and formulate psychologically in a way that incorporates the environment.
Yeah.
And for me, that is a big thing, is about the invisible aspects of kind of racial disparities that exist in access to health or opportunities or resources.
Yeah.
And how those things cascade into the impact in the family home, and the impact between parents and a child, and their ways of coping and responding to problems, and the use of drugs, and what those the histories behind what those things mean, and I think that allowed me to have a more of a what's the word, like a more empathetic stance my clients, rather than one of blame and you're the problem's in you. It's more about actually it's the problem that you've experienced, and that seems to be the drive in which the direction which psychology as a profession seems to be going in now, in the way that we think about distress. It's not about labeling and internalizing distress in a way that a more medical approach might be, actually thinking about what are the environmental cultural factors that influence and shape the way people make sense of their problems. And that's definitely come through my own experience as being a Black person living in the city that I still live.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I could talk a lot for a long time about that. One more thing before we get to the last section. You spoke about your dad influencing your kind of decision to pursue psychology in the first place. How did they feel when you decided that you were going to do undergrad psychology and then go further? Because speaking to in previous podcast episodes, talking to people about career choices, and then, you know, people may not have been as familiar with psychology as a career choice. Like, how did your family and friends react or respond?
Yeah, I mean, neither of my parents went to university in their youth. I mean, my mom did like professional kind of courses. She worked in social care actually. And did like kind of courses and Mandarin courses like through night school. And my dad retrained as a nurse when I was like, as a teenager, really all I do but it was something that my mum was, in particular, was really quite keen for us to do, really, university.
Yeah.
I think the Caribbean community, I don't know if there's the expectation of made, it seems to be the case in maybe some kind of African communities about like old doctors and, you know.
Yeah, the box standard doctor, engineer, lawyer, maybe
lawyer,
teacher.
Yeah. I think there's a kind of a tricky relationship between the education system and the Black Caribbean community because of the histories.
Yeah.
I'm multiple generational. I mean, you know, my grandparents came so to England in their 20s. My mom's generation is my generation. And the whole history of that, which it's not probably to get into now.
It's all right. The episode before I did with an educational psychologist, so we covered it already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. But, yeah, so it's very, something my mum was really keen for us to go to university and get a degree, but there was no kind of expectation about what that was, really.
Right, okay.
No kind of like, and so both my parents worked in the care profession, so my mum was social care, my dad was health.
Right.
And my mum did like some counselling work, and so initially I was going to be like a forensic psychology, I call it criminal psychology, and that was my dual honours.
Right, yeah.
And they're really supportive of it, really.
Yeah.
But as soon as I stepped into that world, it was almost like, there's no frame of reference. Like I was the first person in my for my family to go to, I think, university. Yeah, I think I probably was. I mean, lots of generations below me have. And
yeah, but you were the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was literally just in a world like just on my own, really. Like there was no point of reference. I didn't really, no one really could help me with like sign writing or anything.
Yeah.
And that was a real, like, eye opener, really. And then I think from that, you know, just going to university was a big step, but then doing a master's or a doctorate just seemed to be really alien to most people in my family. And
yeah,
you know, even my granddad now thinks I'm a medical doctor.
I was going to say, did they ask you things like, have you finished yet?
my dad called it, how's the course going? I called that, it's a doctorate, how's the course? And yeah, so it was pretty much like in a white only world, really. And I don't think it really bothered me, really, because I grew up in a kind of multicultural part of Birmingham, and friends of all ethnicities. So that didn't mean, and you know, university is quite liberal places anyway. But I just remember the like people just not really understanding. And obviously, my dad understood eventually because like the psychologist worked in service, and they were a separate thing back then. They weren't actually integrated as much as they are now. Or like writing a PhD, like I don't think people really understood what a thesis really was, and so it was quite lonely and but also they were really supportive, so yes. You know, I was able to live at home for like my master's and my part of the PhD before I missed out. So I was like earning like an NHS wage and like living off, really. And they were really supportive, and my mom would cook me food, and you know, all those kind of things. So like really supportive, really encouraging, and no expectation. And I suppose that it was a real security because I knew that I could take risks. Like I didn't really know what the PhD was when I got into it. I didn't know what the doctor was like when I got into it. I had no one to talk to about it in any detail. I mean, I did have people that supported me on the way, but not like an aunt or uncle to down and say, you know, and that just gave me freedom just to dream, really, and just set myself and my career. And then I just went for it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It does make a difference, even though they might not have been able to support you academically with the actual work. It's that security of feeling safe and being able to kind of explore based on your base. Do you know what I mean? Like you could do it because you knew that they had your back, you had theirs. So you were able to kind of like explore those areas and kind of obviously explored very well because you've got like 4 degrees now. So that's fantastic. My next and last section, but I just wanted to ask, obviously you deal with in your work as well, and you have dealt with like common mental health concerns or conditions, I think that's what they're called. And I just wanted, obviously in this COVID environment, the last year, we've all been trapped inside, which is a very unnatural state. And, you know, there's been reports that there've been increases in anxiety, depression, and other even more severe mental health conditions. And I just wanted to, with your work with the help seeking, I just wanted mainly just how much Have you seen a change in the levels of anxiety, depression, or just general clients coming to you or patients that you're working with? And also, like, how do people, what would advice would you give to people who are suffering or think that they are suffering from early stage depression to anxiety, and how can they can just nip it in the bud a bit?
Yeah. I'm going to be a real psychologist in this answer. Anxiety, low mood, anger are really normal processes that we all go through.
Yeah.
We all experience that. You might recognise it, but if I was to say to you, you know, go and jump into a bear cage, you know, at the zoo, you'd feel floods of anxiety. Or if I was to say to you that, you know, you failed something, you might feel, identify feelings of disappointment and low mood. And so as a psychologist, some of us tend to think about, you know, that throughout life you're going to experience a range of emotions, and that's very normal. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just a part of being human. Anxiety, low mood can be helpful in some tight situations. I suppose what's happened in COVID is that for lots of people, the mechanisms by which we regulate those feelings and emotions have been kind of stripped away for some of us. So if you're someone who, you know, feels low in mood but wants to spend time with your mum's with some home cooking and a hug, then that might be an option for you. And then what do you do with those feelings? Or if someone's quite anxious and you like to kind of, you would, you know, manage that anxiety by, you know, going for a run or going to the gym, that might not be there really. I think we all have different ways of kind of coping and managing our feelings. I suppose COVID has probably eroded some of those coping strategies away. And so I think for most people, I think in this period, I think what's the best thing you can do is trying to find a way to talk to people about what's going on. And that will enable you to connect with how you relate to the problem, really. If you're forever watching, like, binging on Netflix shows for, like, days on end, you're probably trying to numb yourself, potentially, from how you feel. If you're you're drinking heavily, you're trying to block out, and I suppose block out something, you know. You're drinking kind of out the roof in lockdown. It's probably a way in which you're coping to a situation or emotion that you're not really aware of. So I think what I would advise for most people in COVID is actually try to make some space and time to reflect about where you're at with the situation. You might do that kind of via talking, but not everyone is able to be that vulnerable and share where they're at. And some people don't actually have that person. Others might like to do writing or through their note, a voice note on their phone, or a text to themselves, or WhatsApp to themselves, and just begin to connect with where they're at, really. I think that kind of first step is then really helpful in then deciding what you do with it. You know, you might think, actually, this, you know, that might be a quite helpful step for you to then think, this is just normal, and I know it's only temporary. Or actually, you might realise this is something more, and you might then think about, well, what other support mechanisms do I need? There are lots of charities out there that you can access support to talk these things through. You might want to speak to your local general practitioner about what things are available for them in your local area, either low-level counselling or therapy or even medical interventions. You know, and once you're in a health system, then you've got kind of like professional support along the way to get you the right level of support you'll need to overcome from the challenges. But I think for most people, some form of anxiety or low mood is very normal given the context that we're in. And it's, I think my kind of like encouragement to your listeners would be like, it's okay. It's really normal. But share that with someone. Don't keep it on your own. Because I think when you keep it internally on your own, that's when problems manifest and become worse. Does that answer your question, really?
It really does help. And I do like the idea of kind of like checking in with yourself and you know, trying to find a way to figure out what on earth is going on with you. And you can, some people can do that really well by themselves. Some people need to talk to a friend. Other people, it might be seeking low cost therapy via NHS or other charitable services, or even a private therapist. I'm a massive like pro therapist person. Everyone should have therapy. It's a lot easier to access these days than it used to be.
Yeah.
And that obviously now you can have it on Zoom, you can have it on the phone, you can text services, all sorts. So if there's a lot of help out there, and I will put links to some in the description for anybody who needs it. But I think that it's been a rough year for many reasons. Yeah. And, you know, giving yourself that self-compassion, like everybody feels rough and it's okay for you to feel rough because it's been very challenging. So being able to just, you know, accept that and then try some kind of way to help yourself out of it, if that's what you need to do.
And equally, I suppose, if you're kind of self-reflective and you can identify that actually why you're feeling this way, you might be able to notice it in other people and then that kind of like that, like, you know, hand out to them, really, like, you know, how you're getting on, and giving people that space, really. And I think different cultures, different communities do it differently.
Yeah,
I mean, the NHS is the kind of national way.
Yeah,
but you may have religious systems in which you can process these things. You may have a good family network in which these things can be discussed or done through humour or other mechanisms. You know, there's a whole host, and I suppose it's what's right for you, I think, is the point. Battery services are really good, and they can give you the professional help. If you're just trying to figure out what's going on for yourself, or I think about the resources that are already available to you, because it's more likely to be, I think it's going to be sustainable, more easily accessible. You know, or do both. There's no harm. And GPs are really good, you know, confidential places to talk about what's going on for you, really.
Yeah.
I can signpost you to lots of free services that exist in your area if you want that kind of professional way of managing it. And if it is more serious, then they could support you at that level as well, really. So
GP.
Yeah, don't do it alone, basically.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been fantastic. I feel really calm. Obviously, it's part of your job to make people feel calm, but I feel really calm after this recording. So obviously you're good at your job. Not that I was feeling anxious before, but no, I do feel quite calm and fulfilled. So if I was going to say, if there's anything else you wanted to say, but is there anything else you wanted to say?
Not really. I think thanks for having me on the podcast, really. I've done a podcast before. You're the first one. I'm a big podcast person, really. So hopefully speak inspiring to someone who's thinking about, you know, the career or the experiences and an insight into the journey, really. So good work.
Thank you for being so transparent as well, because I do think, like I said, I was not aware of the journey. I do think sometimes it's a bit mystic, like, how do you actually become these things? And spelling it out and going through the stages has been really helpful, even for me, even though I'm not planning to become a clinical psychologist anytime soon. But you never know, still got time. Got loads of years of life, maybe I'll switch. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your honesty and your insights. And how can people, if do you have a social media following that you want to share, or not really?
I do have a Twitter. I'm not the greatest Twitterer though. But I can give you my, it's at LukeB33, and Luke spelled L-U-C.
Okay.
Yeah. Tweet me if people want to chat.
I'm happy
to get back to people and post things that are of interest.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.